morning. Good morning to the first day of February, and welcome to the first February show for Mountain Money. I'm Doug Wells. My co-host this morning is both Roger Goldman and Allison Kulo. Allison's going to join us later this morning. Roger, good morning. Okay, looks like we've got a little technical difficulties, but we'll bring Roger in just a moment. I'm looking out the window. We had a nice weekend, a little new snow over the past week. Hopefully everybody was able to get out and enjoy it. If you weren't able to enjoy it during the week, hopefully you use this weekend as a time to find some fresh powder pockets at the resorts. And today looks like a nice day, a little cloudy, but should be a nice day out there. We won't use the W word, the wind word, because we don't want to jinx things, but looks like a no W yet this morning. We've got a great show this morning. As always, our first guest is Ted Tatos. He's with the University of Utah's Department of Economics, and he's going to join us about the results of the recent Supreme Court case, the NCAA versus Alston. Our second guest is going to be Nick McCollum, of Passive. He's going to join us to talk about their stock portfolio management tool. Really interesting concept. And then we're going to end the hour talking with the new owners at Right at Home, Melissa O'Brien and Tina Pignatelli. All this and more on Mountain Money. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Mountain Money. On the phone with us, we've got Ted Tatos. With the University of Utah. Everybody knows, I mentioned the NCAA, everybody knows that intercollegiate sports are a very big business in this country. In 2016, the NCAA entered into an $8.8 billion extension of its already rich March Madness TV contract, resulting in annual payments of over $1 billion per year. Major conferences are entitled to over $1.4 billion of TV revenues for football in the 2020 season, and millions more flow directly to universities through ticket sales and athletic-driven donations. College sports can also be quite profitable for coaches as well. In some 40 of 50 states, the highest-paid state employee is a college football or basketball coach. Utah may be last in per-pupil spending in our public schools, but Kyle Whittingham, the coach of the Utes football team, ranks first in Utah's public employee salaries at some $4 million per year. And to put that in reference, the president of the university makes about $500,000 a year. These are for numbers in 2018.
But none of this money flows to the athletes. Indeed, the NCAA has a range of very strict rules to ensure that athletes are, quote, amateur student athletes. They work long hours. They're often injured. They're heroics, and their faces are known around the country. So is it fair they don't make any money? And is the NCAA's iron-fisted control of this multi-billion-dollar industry consistent with antitrust laws? This term, the Supreme Court is about to take up a new case examining the relationship between the NCAA and its student athletes, a case that focuses on non-monetary academic benefits. We want to explore this case and its implications, and we are so lucky this morning to be joined by Professor Ted Tatos, an economics professor at the U and the director of empirical analytics. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So Ted, let's start with a little bit of background as to how, as an economist, you view the overall relationship between students and these colleges before we get into how courts have looked at it.
Well, it's really a labor relationship. It's for all intents and purposes, this is it's really like an employee-employer relationship. Although the NCAA and the individual NCAA cartel members really refuse to call them that, but really, when we talk about what an athletic scholarship is, that's really a labor contract. It sets forth what the university is going to provide and what the athletes have to provide in return. So the university provides room and board and ostensibly some level of instruction or hopefully some level of education. And athletes, in return, provide their own brands, and their labor. So, and that labor can be, as you pointed out, many, many hours. So on average, football athletes and basketball athletes spend 40 to 50 hours or more on their sport. So this is really ultimately a labor relationship.
And Roger's the expert on these areas with his legal background, but I do have notes in here. There's really two very important cases we wanted to talk about. One is the O'Bannon case, and then the other is the Alston case that I mentioned in the open. What is the O'Bannon case, and does it have any real impact on college athletes?
Yes, it has an enormous impact. So the O'Bannon case was brought by former UCLA basketball player Charles O'Bannon, and it deals with name, image, and likeness rights. So college athletes have argued, rightly so, that they shouldn't have to give up the rights over their own identities when they sign up to play sports at a university, primarily because no one else has to do that. So no one else, if you receive an academic scholarship from a university, that doesn't preclude you from going out and being a YouTube influencer or writing computer code and getting paid for it or anything of that nature. So the O'Bannon case really deals with whether college athletes should have the same NIL, name, image, likeness rights as everyone else. Alston deals with compensation for college athletes from the universities, or really from anyone else. And I want to be clear about that because it doesn't mandate. No one is arguing that schools should have to pay college athletes. They're simply arguing that schools cannot get together and create these rules as an economic cartel to cap athlete compensation at what was before grant and aid and what is now cost of attendance. So, but those two cases are really related because they both deal with really economic justice for college athletes.
You know, you describe the NCAA or the colleges as a cartel, and I think as we think about this, most of the time when I hear the word cartel, I think, wow. The courts really, really look down on that. They really restrict the ability to that. So how has the NCAA been treated differently? And how do you think the analytical rubric of what you call economic justice will come to bear as the courts look at it now?
Well, so just to be clear on the use of the term cartel, the NCAA has been recognized to be an economic cartel for many, many years. In fact, oddly enough, the NCAA's antitrust expert in the O'Bannon case had previously referred to the NCAA as an economic cartel in his own textbook. So now, as you pointed out, the NCAA really likes to avoid that term, or at best when they say, well, we may be a cartel, but we're a cartel that does good things, which is, of course, nonsense. But what they prefer to call themselves is a joint venture. Now, for all intents and purposes, the NCAA is a cartel. They're a group of universities and colleges who have gotten together and conspired to limit athlete compensation. Now, normally when we have a cartel like this, and we examine it as, let's say, a price-fixing arrangement, which is really the mirror image of the wage-fixing arrangement that we have here. But nonetheless, they're both very similar concepts, just from a different angle. Normally, these are viewed as per se illegal. that is they're harmful just by their very existence. And by harmful, I mean they cause the type of injury that antitrust laws were designed to prevent. With sports, it's treated a little bit differently because courts have maintained that there has to be some degree of concerted behavior just for the product to exist at all, right? I mean, they have to get together to make rules, they have to get together to make their schedules and so forth. So because of that, the NCAA is treated under what's called the rule of reason. And that's a slightly, very much an easier standard for the NCAA to defend. Now, the point, the big issue there is that in addition to recognizing that they have to get together to fix, to make rules, court size and so on, they've also extended that to say, well, that also allows us to make rules regarding the price or regarding the wages that college athletes are allowed to earn. And that to me is to call it a step too far would be an understatement.
And so let's give our audience some background on the Alston case. We talked about what it is. Alston prevailed in the lower courts. It went to the Ninth Circuit Court, and now it's been passed on to the Supreme Court. My understanding is the discussion has been held at the Supreme Court, but we don't know what the results are yet. Give us some thoughts as to where we are now and when we can expect to hear what the Supreme Court rules.
So first, it hasn't been heard by the Supreme Court yet. So the parties have submitted their briefs. And the Supreme Court has agreed to hear it, and there have been some amicus briefs filed. But right now, it's where this case stands is yes, the plaintiffs technically prevailed in the lower courts. That is to say, yes, the court found the NCAA. In violation of antitrust laws, but it's a very limited victory. In other words, the court said, well, you can't limit education-related compensation. And part of the reason, the main reason why the court was somewhat constrained in its ruling is because of the Ninth Circuit's previous decision in O'Bannon. And there the court said, well, you can't have payments to students that are untethered to education. So yes, it was a victory. Yes, the Ninth Circuit upheld the district court's decision, and now it's before the Supreme. It stands before the Supreme Court, but it really is a narrower victory than. But at least at the lower courts, it was a narrower victory than I think plaintiffs and many of us would have liked to see.
And Ted, if I can, a quick aside. Roger, you're the one that mentioned that this is an important case. We should talk about it. What is it about the case that caught your attention? Why do you think this is an important case for our audience to know about?
The Alston case?
Yeah, actually, I was asking my co-host that, Roger. What was it about this case that you said, wow, this is really important, we should discuss it?
Well, I think that the sort of overall issue of what our guest has talked, economic justice, as the business of sports continues to grow, the notion that these millions and billions of dollars are flowing to universities while the students aren't getting anything, really bothers a lot of people. And it seems strange that the jurisprudence as it's developed to this point has sort of said, yeah, well, as our guest says, you know, college athletes are different. When you had the O'Bannon case, that was sort of a little bit of a move away from that tolerance. And I think Alston presents the court with an opportunity to possibly open that door a little bit wider. You know, in other words, if you say, well, we're not going to limit how much non-academic aid you can get. I'm sorry, how much academic aid you can get. So I guess my question, that's why I thought it was interesting. And again, when you have a case get to the court, you don't know what's going to happen. And we have a new lineup at the court. So I guess I would turn to Ted and say, what do you think, given our current lineup of the court, they're likely to do? I mean, in a sense, both sides wanted this appealed because I think the plaintiffs thought it was too narrow, and obviously the NCAA thought it was too broad. And by the way, one thing I did note was that both sides have enlisted a lineup of superstar advocates. I mean, they've got the NCAA's got Seth Waxman, the former Solicitor General, and the plaintiffs have, I think, the Winston & Strawn firm. What do you think? How do you think the court's likely to look at this one, Ted?
Well, that's a very difficult question. I think the judiciary would like to have the Congress handle this one, and I think I absolutely think that Congress should, particularly from a name, image, and likeness point of view. And I think those kinds of discussions have already begun in Congress as far as do we need a nationwide name, image, and likeness rule? Because right now the individual states are creating what the NCAA has called a patchwork, and you know they've argued that we should have one rule. And my thought on that is that the rule should be students should college athletes should have the same rights as everyone else. That is to say, just benefit from your own name, image, and likeness rights, just as any other college student does. But predicting what the court is likely to do in Alston is very difficult. The antitrust cases are, you know, somewhat difficult for, particularly rule of reason cases, are difficult for plaintiffs. But I think the fact that we've had a pandemic and we still have one, that has really exposed the NCAA for what it truly is and what its interests are, which is to say, money. That is the NCAA's overarching principle, to make more money. And whether the court is going to be cognizant of that, I think they will be. I do think that they will take the opportunity to clarify some of the dicta that were made in the Board of Regents case in the mid-1980s. How they're going to rule, that's a tough one. I certainly hope they rule for the plaintiffs. I'll make that clear, but it's very difficult to predict that.
Let me ask another question, which is one way of dealing with a dysfunction in the labor market is through antitrust laws. But another way historically has been through unionization. And I believe at one point the Northwestern football team tried to unionize. Talk to us a little bit about, you know, what the potential is for athletes forming labor unions.
I think the potential is greater now than it was over the past 4 years. I think the under the previous administration, we saw a very aggressive disregard for labor rights. That's including the NLRB. And so on. So I do think that there's a greater chance, and I think the fact that the Pac-10 and the Big Ten athletes really started stepping up and saying, "Wait a second, this is right." So they've indicated an interest in forming some type of student. Of college athlete union. they absolutely should be able to do that. There's absolutely no question that they should be able to get together and form their own union to protect their own interests. They already have, for all intents and purposes, an employee-employer relationship. The problem is that right now they're not viewed as employees, and the NCAA has really militated against giving them or allowing that recognition to accrue to college athletes. But I think once that happens, I think that will break open the door. Now the NCAA will try to infiltrate that and try to undermine it to the highest extent possible. But I do think there's much greater likelihood now than there was over the last 4 years.
Ted, let me ask you. I think our audience listening, I'm kind of the third wheel in this discussion, which is absolutely fine. It's fascinating for me as well as a business person. You know, Roger's an attorney, a very accomplished attorney, now retired. Park City is lucky to have him. Also, the new chairman of KPCW's Board of Trustees. So, Roger, we thank you for that. But, Ted, as I hear you talk, I hear a very astute understanding of how the legal system works. And I try to do my homework before I ask questions. And so I was just curious on your educational background. And I'm surprised, as far as I can tell, you're not an attorney. You actually, and this is a compliment to the University of Utah, you actually have your master's in statistics and econometrics. I'm curious, how did you partly, most people, when we think of statisticians, do not think of somebody as articulate and able to put forth their argument as well-formed as you are. That's a different skill set typically than somebody that is interested enough in statistics to get their master's in it. How did you go from a master's in statistics to this type of analysis?
Well, first, thank you very much for those kind words. I really appreciate them. The work that I do is at the crossroads of economics and statistics and the legal profession. I am not a lawyer. What I do is litigation consulting. So I do a lot of expert witness testimony in various types of cases. So and a lot of those are antitrust cases. Over the last several years, I became particularly interested in the NCAA cases. In large part because of the academic fraud scandal that occurred at UNC Chapel Hill, and for listeners who are not familiar with that, this was a system of really fraudulent courses that existed at UNC, really one of the crown jewels of public education in the United States. That existed at UNC over two decades, really, in large part, the purpose of those courses was to keep athletes eligible to play sports so that the university could profit. So what that essentially says is it really undermines the whole NCAA argument that, well, this is really about education, that what they are is really about opportunities, because they're not providing an education. They're not allowing athletes to benefit in their own, from their own talents, from their own brands that they've developed. So at that point, I became very interested in, well, what does antitrust have to say about this? How can this possibly exist, given the fact that we have the Sherman Antitrust Act on the books for so long? So that's how I became very, very interested in this particular issue.
Ted, we're really glad you did, because it's been very helpful to us this morning, and I hope perhaps you'd consider coming back after we get the Supreme Court's decision to help us understand what it means.
I would love to.
All right. We've been talking to Ted Tatos, the professor at the University of Utah Department of Economics. Mountain Money will be right back after this.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. Fascinating conversation. As I said, during that conversation, Roger and Ted really had the expertise there. I'm really excited for our next guest because I have a tiny bit of expertise in this area as well, so it makes me a little more comfortable. Our guest is Nick McCollum. He is with the company Passive, and Passive is a portfolio management tool. I use very powerful portfolio management tools in my day-to-day job, or I should say my team uses it. But Passive is a tool for everybody else. So I'm really interested in this conversation. Nick, thank you for joining us on Mountain Money.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So let's start off with, what is Passive and why is it important for the average person to consider using a tool like this?
Passive is an innovative portfolio management platform that you can use to pair directly to your brokerage account and make it much easier to manage your own portfolio of investments. The reason why a tool like Passive is important is because managing your own investments can be really hard, and our mission statement as a company is to make DIY investing accessible for everyone. So creating really easy to use and simple tools that make that easier to do, that's kind of why it's important for us to do what we do today.
So Passive is not just the name of the company, but it's also the type of philosophy that the of investing that this product helps with. Can you talk a little bit about passive investment?
Absolutely. So within the realm of investing, there's kind of two main schools of thought. The first would be active investing. So that's basically the philosophy that you want to pick stocks or other investments that are going to do better than the market. So you rely on research and kind of fundamental bottoms-up decision-making to do that. The other main philosophy would be passive investing, which is what we're proponents of. Passive investing kind of relies more on broad market exposure, and instead of trying to pick individual winners from among the stock market, you just want to invest in a little bit of all the stocks in the stock market so that as the markets tend to rise over time, you'll be a beneficiary of that broad kind of market growth with a lot of diversification built in.
And I find the term passive investing to be a misnomer because there are thousands of different ETFs. So you can use these broad-based tools to get exposure to different areas, but yet there's a lot of choices to be made within there. For instance, on one of the pages on your webpage, I believe it's your homepage, you've got somebody doing a buy and a sell, and they're selling this iShares Core MSCI All Country Exchange, and they're buying a Vanguard FTSE Canada All Cap IDX. And that gets complicated very quickly. Does your tool help average investors understand what some of these tools are and how to choose which one makes sense in their portfolio, or which ones, I should say?
So our mission as a company is to make DIY investing accessible for everyone. So we spend most of our time building towards that mission by developing our software. But we recognize that investing is kind of a difficult endeavor to get started out on your own. So to the extent that we can also empower investors through education and provide lots of really good educational resources for them, we do that a lot of that as well. So we have a really kind of robust blog. We can learn lots about all of the different types of investing strategies and ETFs. We also have individual resources where we can read about the particulars of individual ETFs and stocks. And then we also have lots of like feature pages and tutorials on our website that show people exactly how to use our passive software.
It's my understanding that the idea for Passive and this software came from just the realization that expensive investment products would add years to your working life. And so with that, you know, how did this whole software begin? I can't imagine that it was an easy first step.
Yeah, the initial prototype of Passive was built by one of our co-founders to solve actual real world problems that he was having when he was trying to manage his own family's finances. So basically the problem that he encountered was he was trying to manage his own retirement account. He was also trying to manage his wife's retirement account. And he was trying to manage two education savings plans for his kids as well. So four different accounts with four different kind of target asset allocations, and keeping track of all of this became really tedious. He you know, he wanted to have a certain mix of stocks and bonds in each account that was slightly different. So to keep track of all of this, he had just a monster spreadsheet, and he would input all of his holdings every month. He would input how much more cash he had added to the account, and then in the spreadsheet would tell him what he needed to buy or sell to get as close as possible to the target portfolio that he wanted. So that was really time-consuming. And then even once all of that was done, he had to go into his broker and execute all of his trades one by one. So the initial prototype of Passive was just a basic Python script that read, you know, Brendan's account holdings directly from his brokerage account, so he no longer had to do manual data entry. Since then, we've added many more features, including the ability to rebalance your portfolio with one click, and that's kind of the problem that we encounter that we're trying to solve.
So you described kind of the problem that Brendan had, and I'm listening to this as myself, and my kids have 529 plans, I have a retirement plan, but I have no idea what necessarily you just said. You know, I just kind of let it ride. Could someone like me be able to jump onto a system like this and figure it out? Or does it really take kind of another level or a higher level of kind of DIY investor?
No, we are definitely working to make investing accessible for everyone, not just people who are like really passionate about it or maybe like, you know, personal finance nerds. So what a lot of our users end up doing is they'll find like a really cost-effective, evidence-based model portfolio published by a financial advisor or something like that. And so that tells them what they want to invest in. And then they will use Passive to actually implement the investment over time by using our software to make sure that they're on track to kind of achieve their long-term financial goals.
So again, it's kind of step-by-step, or there's some how-tos?
Yeah, absolutely. And the whole idea of Passive, I guess, is that once you kind of decide what you want to be invested in, either on your own or with the help of like an online financial advisor or something like that, once you've decided what you want your asset allocation to be, you spend a bit of time at the outset configuring your account so that Passive knows how you want to be invested. And then for the rest of your investment lifetime, it's basically wealth automation on autopilot.
And Nick, I've been in the industry now for a long time. And when I joined, it I think trades were about $100 to buy and sell. Particularly ETFs were a little more expensive than stocks, and that's all changed over the period of time, over a lifetime, really, for me. And a lot of custodians now, the trades are in order to rebalance. You said you can rebalance on a click. The problem is if you have 10 or 15 ETFs, and if it costs $30 to do each one, every time you rebalance, 10 times $30 a trade is $300. Could be $600 because you're selling something and you're buying something. The world's different now. Explain to our audience what it costs to do some of this rebalancing at their custodian.
Yeah, so a lot of places now are zero fee trades. So that what that means is you can buy or sell investments without actually you know, having to pay a fee. So that's great. That's kind of going to save investors a lot of money over time. And for brokerages who aren't no fee commission brokerages, Passive allows you to kind of configure your rebalancing settings so that you're not paying undue fees. So there's a couple different ways you do it, but one of the more kind of easy to understand ones is just disabling selling to rebalance. So what that means is when we rebalance your portfolio for you, we'll never sell anything. We'll only use your new cash to buy your underweight assets. So that immediately cuts your commission by about half. So lots of different ways you can kind of go about saving yourself on investment fees when using the Passive investing software.
In my understanding, Allison mentioned she's got a 529. Allison, that's probably at the state of Utah, the my 529 plan. Utah has a good 529 plan. My understanding, Nick, is your tool can interact with other, what I would call custodians, where the investments are held, in this case in the 529. Is that correct? And if it is, how do you do that securely? I mean, it almost seems like you'd need the login credentials for people, which is something I would frown upon.
Yeah, so that's a really good question. Security is a core fundamental part of our business, and it's really, really important to us. So I'll just answer your first question first, and then we'll talk more about security. So Passive is kind of designed to be able to connect to multiple different places at once. So if you had some of your investments at TD Ameritrade and you had some of your other investments at Interactive Brokers, Passive would actually allow you to connect to both of those places at once and manage your entire investment portfolio in one centralized dashboard. So that's a feature that a lot of our users love and they get a lot of utility of. In terms of security, so the way that we connect with your brokerage accounts to read your holdings and make your trades, we don't actually store or save or ask for your login information like you alluded to. So we use a protocol called OAuth, which allows us to connect with your brokerage account without getting your login information. The way it works is you go to our website, you go to connect a new brokerage, and instead of having to put in your login credentials on our website or anything like that, you get redirected to the brokerage's website. You grant us permission there, and then the brokerage will redirect you back to our website with permission. So it's a kind of the preferred and most secure way of interacting with other people's software, and that's how it's kind of the protocol that we've built our business on.
Okay, great. Well, I'm glad to hear about the cybersecurity because obviously, you know, people are saving their nest egg. It's critically important. The last thing you'd want to do is log in and find out that there's a surprise. So I've been on your website. The software that my firm use costs tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars a year to use. It definitely would add years to anybody's life to be able to pay for something like that. Talk to us about your structure. I know you have a free tier and then a premium tier. What does that cost your average user?
Yeah, so we have, like you said, two different ways that you can use Passive. There's a free plan for Passive, which is called Passive Community, and that gives you kind of access to a limited feature set of within the Passive software that you can use to determine whether or not you want to use Passive to manage your investment portfolio with no obligations and no fees. So that's good. And then the other way you can use Passive is through our paid software, which is called Passive Elite. And Passive Elite costs $99 a year. It gives you access to everything that Passive has to offer, including one-click trades and the ability to interact with multiple brokerages at once.
So knowing that you've got the free and the premium, are there things or how is Passive as a organization company looking to grow and expand? Would you be looking at adding new levels to that kind of user participation, or would you be adding things to the already existing levels?
We've always wanted to keep our pricing as simple and as transparent as possible. So we don't have plans at this time to like modify our pricing schema or anything like that. For us, a big source of our growth is just going to be integrating with more brokerages. So every time we launch one of these new brokerage integrations, there's kind of a lot of software engineering that goes into it to make sure that the integration works like it should. There's a lot of testing that goes into it. So we're always kind of in progress of integrating with more brokerages, and that's something that we're laser focused on moving forward.
And what are the major brokerages that Passive works with now?
Yeah, so we have, I guess, six integrations right now. We'll probably have eight by the time this month's over. But the six that we have now are Questrade here in Canada, and then TD Ameritrade, Interactive Brokers, Tradier, and Alpaca.
Okay, and I'm suspecting a lot of folks, most of those custodians, maybe with, I think you said TD Ameritrade, most of those custodians are names that most people here in Utah have not heard of, have not worked with. What about names like Fidelity and Schwab, some of the bigger brand names? Are those custodians that you're hopeful to have on in the next 12 months?
Yeah, we're hoping to integrate with every major brokerage, you know, eventually. We're a bit limited in the sense that some brokerages don't have open APIs, so that's kind of like what we need from their technology team in order for us to build the secure integrations that we want from our end. So not all brokerages have that. And in our view, that's like, they're doing a bit of a disservice to their user base because it kind of limits their users' ability to get access to innovative tools like Passive. There's definitely going to be more and more progress towards an open API economy as time passes and technology becomes more mainstream. But right now that's a kind of a big limiting factor for us in getting integrated with more brokerages.
So, Nick, how can our listeners find out more about Passive?
If you're interested in learning more about our investing software, check out our website at passive.com. There's no E on the end of Passive. It's just PASSIV.com.
Great. And, Nick, before we let you go, anything else you'd like to share with our audience?
I'd just like to say thanks for the opportunity to come on and talk about Passive. It's been a pleasure speaking with you both.
Okay. Same here. We've been speaking with Nick McCollum. He is with Passive, which is a portfolio management tool, both a freemium as well as a premium model. And up next, we're going to talk to the new owners of Right at Home. Please stay tuned. Welcome back to Mountain Money. Fascinating conversation about passive portfolio management, an area I knew a little bit about. And now we're going to delve back into an area I know much less about. I do know about the wonderful store here in town called Right at Home. And we have the new owners of Right at Home joining us. They are sisters Melissa O'Brien and Tina Pignatelli. Melissa and Tina, thank you for joining us.
It's nice to be on.
Great. Well, thanks for...
Tina is just joining. She's having a little trouble with the other call-in number, so we'll take it together.
No
okay.
worries.
That sounds great. Right at Home is an icon here in town. What was it about it, their business, that you said, hey, this would be nice for this coming chapter of your lives to be associated, to be owners of it?
So it's actually a really great story. Tina and I moved to town about 15 years ago. And we knew at least one of the owners at that time, Eileen Mullane. And we told her, if you ever consider selling the store, will you think of us? And every time we would see her, we would remind her. And in October, Eileen and Marion and Cindy came to us and they said, we're ready. And so it's such a great story about relationships in Park City and keeping in touch with people and putting it out to the universe what you might want.
How long has Right at Home been? Been there? Because when you say, you moved 15 years ago, I feel like that's kind of when they opened.
Yeah, they actually opened the store in 2001. So we're coming up on the 20th year anniversary in November of this year.
So quite a staple for the community and for you to come in. For those listening who do not know what Right at Home is, tell the listeners about it.
Sure. Well, it's such a wonderful business. It started off primarily as consignment furniture and has really expanded over the years to include home accessories and gifts and a combination of both new and upcycled consigned furniture. Has wonderful high-end goods, and it changes daily. Truly, the inventory is constantly moving out of that store, so it's always a treasure hunt.
Park City is such a fun community because we do have people that are willing to invest in quality merchandise for their homes. I love going to garage sales here in Park City because you never know what you're going to find. Same thing with consignment stores. Talk to us about some of the really unique stuff that maybe you have now or you've seen over the years to kind of pique people's interest to come in. As you say, the inventory turns over. What are some real gems that you've seen?
Well, we see such a variety in styles, which is really fun because you can find pieces from all different, genres. We also have a lot of merchandise from local artists, which is also, kind of a testament to Park City and supporting those local artists. But right now on the floor, we have, a large space at 1745 Bonanza Drive, and we have couches, we have wonderful dining tables and chairs, side tables, really a little bit of everything, lots of accessories right now, lamps, serving dishes. People bring in things from all periods of their life, which is kind of fun. We had a couple come in a couple of weeks ago with a table that was his childhood table that was a unique piece. So like Tina said, it really is different every time you walk through the door.
A few years ago, I was going through there looking for an armoire, and they were able to put me on a waiting list to contact me if one were to come available. But from what I heard, there was quite a few people on the list. And they just recommended that I come through the store frequently. How frequently should someone be coming through the store if they're looking for items? How often do things turn over?
Oh, I would recommend at least weekly. Things change so fast, but to your point, we do keep a list. So if you came in and said, I really would like to find a round dining room table, we would note that. And if one came in, give you a call and let you know that one has come into the store. So we try and keep that list updated and maintain good contact with customers who are looking for something specific.
And then I guess on the reverse side, for those that are looking to bring their furniture to you on consignment, is there a waiting period? Do you have room all the time? Would the piece, be able to be put on the floor that day?
So that does vary, just depending on, you know, the demand for space. And we would let somebody know that, you know, at the time that we looked at their furniture, if it couldn't go out right away, we would let them know that, and they can make that choice. Right now with COVID, it's better to, you know, give us a heads up before just showing up with furniture so that, you know, we can let you know if there's space or not.
Well, the other point is that even if you needed to get rid of your furniture now, that's okay. Go ahead and call us because we have storage. And it may not go immediately on the floor, but we can still take it. And as soon as there's space, we'll put it out.
So as an example, my wife and I are entering our empty nest year. So there's stuff that we needed or my kids needed and they no longer need. Can you help people with the hassle factor of getting furniture from point A to point B? Do you have pickup service, or do you have people that you can refer them to make that happen?
We absolutely have a list of referrals. Moving companies that we work with in the community, and, you know, don't let that be an impediment to bringing your furniture to right at home. We can help you with that.
And we'll also come to your home to help price it and let you know, before you take the hassle of bringing it in, what we would price it for in the store.
I think that was right where my next question was going to be, is pricing. I mean, I have no clue what to price something. And I assume, you know, you base it upon, you know, how you've seen things go before. Is that correct?
That's correct. And the current owners, Marion and Cindy and Eileen, have been such great mentors in that, and tutors in that. So we pay a lot of attention to what they've been doing. We've been able to be in the store, you know, off and on over these last few months to observe kind of how they handle that. But yes, a little bit of that is just experience.
And you know, that experience is so important. This is a big active town. I had a mountain bike, an extra one for friends. And then I upgraded my bike, so I had two extra ones. I didn't need two extra ones. And I jumped on, in my case, an online forum where you sell. And I was shocked at how much my old bike was worth. Is your general assessment, how is pricing now given the COVID world? Have you seen, we've had a lot of new people move into town. Has that driven prices higher or driven them lower?
I don't think it's driven them either way, but I will say that with people moving to town and also people buying places that are fully furnished and then they want to, you know, change it out, we have had an incredible run over the past couple months with people both shopping and selling. So the inventory has turned over, you know, like never before, in my opinion.
So you had mentioned that you've been working since October, really, to make the sale happen. And congratulations, today is your first official day as owners. But it's not that you haven't been doing other things. Melissa, I know that you've been on KPCW quite a bit with Snyderville Basin Recreation District, which is not retail.
No, it's not.
Yeah. So tell me about this transition for both of you, because Tina, as well, I understand that, again, your background is not necessarily in retail as well.
That's right. We try to keep it a big secret, but we're both lawyers by training. And I have been with Basin Recreation for 5 years. And I'm the Planning and Legal Affairs Manager. That's how I was hired and what I do currently, although I did have a six-month stint as the Interim District Director from July until December. But we have hired a new District Director, and she is just fantastic and wants to, you know, keep me on at Basin Rec and is being very flexible on my schedule. So I will stay in both places. But the good news is Right at Home is kind of a family affair. And so Tina and I will be here off and on. And then Tina's husband is also working, Daniel, my mom, our dad. So it's definitely all of us working together to make this a successful venture.
And my understanding is today's the first day of your new ownership. So as given that you're both attorneys, you know, the deal's not done till the deal's not done. So is the deal done now? Are you officially the new owners?
The deal is very close to being done. We're just closing this afternoon. But yes, it is. We are here this morning. We opened the store. It actually opens at 10 a.m., which is in just a couple minutes. And so it is the first day of the new venture. We're really excited. We hope that all of Park City will come shop and visit us. And also Eileen and Cindy and Marion will be around. So they're definitely not, making an abrupt exit. They will be helping us.
Well, it's an exciting day for you, and thank you for sharing part of that with us. Our guests have been Melissa O'Brien and Tina Pignatelli. Pignatelli, thank you.
You got Pignatelli. You got it.
All right. Excellent. It took me
a try. Thanks so much for having us on.
Okay. Good luck, and stay tuned to Mountain Money. We'll be back in a moment. And welcome back to Mountain Money. We want to thank our great sponsors for a show, for sponsoring us and letting us do shows like this. We had a little bit of everything. So no matter what your interest level is, we had something for you this morning. Our great sponsors include Jan's Mountain Outfitters, First Community Bank, Columbus Pacific Development with Pendry Residences, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Property, and San Francisco Design.
And as Doug said, we had a plethora of types of conversations this morning. We were able to talk sports with Ted Tatos regarding the NCAA Alston Supreme Court case coming up. We spoke with Nick McCollum with Passive regarding investing. And then we finished the hour with Melissa O'Brien and Tina Pignatelli, new owners of Right at Home. So a little small business.
Hey, what I really found fascinating is we had a very legal conversation with our very own attorney, Roger Goldman, but also with somebody that's not an attorney. And then we had a really fun, fascinating conversation about a new business with attorneys who aren't practicing as attorneys now. They're running a retail business here in Park City. It's part of what makes this town so fun.
And it is fun to hear that they've been in town for a long time, have really wanted to be a part of this business, and now have made it happen.
Yeah, it's kind of funny how, they use the term put out into the universe what they wanted. And I think that's so important. It's important in life, and it's also important in your career. You know, we had a guest maybe a year ago, 2 years ago, that talked about your boss is not a mind reader. If you want something at work, make sure that the people you work with know that.
Not only is your boss not a mind reader, no one around you is a mind reader. So it's always really important to think of that. Doug, we've got a great show coming up next week. One of the things that have been in the news quite a bit is GameStop, and we've got someone chatting about that.
Yeah, it's going to be really fascinating. A senior reporter from CNBC. Unfortunately, as much fun as this show has been, we need to wrap up. You're listening to KPCW Park City. NPR is next.